Welcome to Screen Talk, IndieWire's weekly podcast. This is a very special edition, divorced from the news cycle, as it were, because we recorded it in advance of our vacation. So we're coming to you from the past, and we don't know if something crazy happened in the future. So we apologize that we can't talk about those things, but it tends to be a slower time of the year. So knock on wood, everything we're discussing today is relevant. We came up with a list of 10 stories that we feel really defined this year in film. And I have to give you credit, really, you came up with this list and I'm kind of okay with it. But there are some that I think are more relevant to me than to you and vice versa. So
I figured that out. I said, Eric can talk about this. And we'll start with number 10. Number 10 is Eric's. Go for it.
So let's kick things off with the subject matter that I think has been most relevant to our conversations throughout the year, because it keeps changing, and that's film festivals. Right when South by Southwest was canceled back in March, we knew things were going to be different this year. And when film festivals were canceled and pushed, there was this constant sense that everything was going to be upended. And when Cannes Film Festival kept trying to go further and further and further and finally realized they couldn't happen, you knew that there were some severe platforms for cinema all around the world that just wouldn't be able to do their job in the usual way this year. And what we've learned is that virtual film festivals can happen in a way that is impactful. I thought that both Toronto and New York especially showed that, and we'll see what happens with Sundance. And the good news is that
Venice was very much a hybrid. It was live too.
Venice actually showed that you could have a physical festival. That is not a dead thing. So I think what we're looking at in the future is that some aspect of what a virtual film festival is going to be, whether platforms like Shift 72 continue to have a role in that, I don't know, but some aspect of the virtual film festival is going to continue to be a part of the physical festival because it allows them to bring in more audiences. What we don't know is when that shift is going to start happening. We have to look at that vaccine rollout and how events start coming back. Right now, it looks like both Sundance, South by Southwest, that whole first quarter of sorts is not going to be able to fully take advantage of what a hybrid approach might look like. But maybe in the summer, which Tribeca is looking at for its proceedings, we'll start to inch back toward then. Hopefully by the fall season, it'll feel a bit more like normalcy again.
But we'll absolutely see. And I do think that Tom Powers, also at Doc NYC, has shown, especially, and I think New York too, and Toronto, they all created these platforms that made it possible for people all over the country to participate and see different kinds of panels and all sorts of, I think these innovations will continue, is my point, that we will see more of this even after the pandemic is over. Theaters were under assault this year. It's really painful to watch. Something that was already happening, there was a lot of pressure on theaters from the studios to reduce their windows. There were opportunities for deals that didn't take place. And eventually Universal and AMC came to terms. At the time, it seemed like Universal was the bad guy and the theaters were angry with them. But they were going to go to PVOD and all this. But what really ended up happening is that everybody with a streaming option, because of COVID, because of the ongoing problems with cinema, because Tenet didn't do well, in theaters, even though Chris Nolan was pushing for it and everybody thought it could be the savior. In the end, it's had a terrible impact on the theaters, and they're struggling. Luckily, the bailout, the most recent bailout, is going to help independent theaters, any of the smaller theaters under a certain threshold. I don't know what's going to happen at this writing, at this moment, at this taping, to the big theater chains. That's a big question mark. But there is money coming.
We know that this will be a big question mark for some time, irrespective of how much money they get. Also, because audiences aren't all ready to go back to the theaters, and when they
especially New York and LA, which remain shut down, they never
opened. And when they go back, what are they going to go see? I mean, it's going to be an interesting open question throughout the year. So this is not the last you'll hear about this, nor is it the last you'll hear about our eighth item on this list: the rise of virtual cinemas and drive-ins, because the virtual cinema concept has been sort of an ongoing experiment for distributors. Kino Marquee, I think, was sort of a pioneer in this in terms of what it did with this approach of being able to rent a movie on the website of a theater and splitting the revenue, so it actually creates some revenue for the theater. At the end of the day, this is not enough to keep an art house's doors open, but it is an important gesture in the sense that these are really hard hit independent institutions that need whatever money they can get. And right. Again, it's creating a different model for getting movies out using the kind of the word of mouth, the communities that these theaters provide. So I think there is value in that. The rise of drive-ins has been amusing in a sense, you know, like radio, it ends up being this incredibly resilient format, even though it seems kind of dated. I assume that when we get back to some sense of normalcy, it's not like everybody's going to have this new hunger for drive-ins all across the country, but it has been valuable to see that apparatus exists and has a certain role to play in our movie-going culture. So I'm glad that people went to drive-ins this year, and I'm glad they were there to help film festivals like New York Film Festival have some kind of event.
It was good to see Nomadland on a big screen, exactly. Even if it was at a drive-in. Yeah.
Yeah, or Dance in My Car to American Utopia. It happens.
You got to do that in New York. All right. So then, as I mentioned, PVOD obviously has become a huge deal, and Universal especially. But over, you know, even when Disney took Mulan to the streaming site, they were charging a certain premium for it. And there's a whole, you know, model that has developed where movie plays in theaters and either goes day and date and goes straight to PVOD, or it goes, and there's just a huge price range. And Tom Brueggemann on our site has been following this and documenting it and showing how they're all experimenting. How do the different price points work at different points in time? They're all learning things that they could have learned a long time ago. Again, if that relationship between the studios and the theaters hadn't been so fractured, what will it be after COVID when we go back to normal, whatever that is? We don't know. This is a PVOD is very much of a COVID situation.
Well, the one thing about PVOD that I think is I keep hearing from people is that the price tag does still scare people off at first.
Yes.
You know, why would I pay $20 to watch Freaky or whatever? Just wait a little bit. It's sort of an evolved version of why would I pay $20 to go see it in theaters? I'll just wait until it comes out on VOD. People have learned that it's, you know, you can wait a little bit longer and that price drops. And I'm not sure, unless it's a Tenet type of movie, that the argument is just sort of baked into its availability.
Films are the ones that seem to provide some value if you've got a group of people who are going to watch it over and over again, and kids are involved. Go ahead, Eric, with number six.
So the number six on our countdown is the COVID impact on indies, which I've been looking at from so many different angles, from the level of insurance challenges it creates to safety measures on set. Obviously, that outburst from Tom Cruise was on a big budget Hollywood movie, but I do think it epitomizes the fragility of working on sets. There was this sort of apocalyptic moment where everything shut down, and then a gradual sort of crawling back with new kinds of safety metrics in place. Netflix has been doing, I think, really fascinating industry leading work in terms of crunching the numbers to figure out different sizes of bubbles. If you're a really scrappy indie and you don't have that luxury, you have to sort of reinvent your approach in a way to be loose and nimble, and people have. And I have to tell you, a lot of folks were asking me when this first started happening, like, are we just not going to have film and TV shows for a bit? Like, is there going to be some drop off? There won't be. People have gotten stuff made. As soon as they finished Jurassic World, you could tell there would be this kind of trickle-down.
No, they figured out it's interesting to be where we are now and look back. I mean, there was a time when it looked impossible. It just looked like too daunting and too, but Steven Soderbergh and the DGA and the PGA and all the different groups, they really did get together and come up with protocols that they could follow. And the economic incentive was so great. Unfortunately, right now, there's a problem with the surge. And so there's more and more cases being reported. I hope they all stop over the holidays and just give it a bit of a breath, because it feels more dangerous now than it has been.
Well, I think the end of the day, what we learned is that people thrive on the work and they're willing to figure out the best way to get it done as long as it seems like it's not too reckless. Because, you know, some of this stuff is risky anyway. I mean,
especially for the actors. Yeah,
for the actors. I mean, from an economic standpoint, these things are risky. There's a lot of different reasons to not make movies anyway. So this was one more hurdle that people had to figure out, and they did. So
yeah, they did. Great. But the other hurdle is that indies still have issues with getting insurance until after
that.
There will be a big sort of bulging snake of product going through the pipeline that's going to. Some of it is going to go, all right, this is part of what we're talking about. So the studios have been responding rather dramatically. Again, we're talking about a long period of time. We're talking about almost 10 months here that these changes have occurred. And it's been really rapid to see each of the studios one by one overhauling, laying off people, which is tragic, reorganizing. And in each case, Universal, Warner Brothers, Disney, especially the ones that have streamers, making the shift to putting streaming at the forefront of their business model. That was not true before. And think about Warner Brothers, you know, the mighty studio, the Terry Semel, Bob Daly era, you know, Stanley Kubrick, Clint Eastwood, all the movies that they would churn out, and, you know, 30 movies a year. And they were the dominant movie studio was dominant. There was TV and movies. Now movies are way down the food chain. And it's about product that's going to the streamer. And obviously Warner Brothers at the end made this very dramatic shift with Jason Kilar in charge of Warner Media, perhaps too violently and suddenly and not taking care of all the creatives on the team. 17 movies going through HBO Max in 2021, starting with this Christmas with Wonder Woman 1984, going simultaneously to theaters and HBO Max.
Let's call it what it is. It's
the most shift,
the most derided decision in Hollywood this year.
No, he could lose his job.
The press was uniformly negative. The response, the fact that you have these, you know, major directors like Denis Villeneuve and obviously Christopher Nolan publicly lambasting them for that. I mean, that is just not what you want in terms of, and I think the challenge is that they knew that the pushback was going to be so extreme that they had to just go for it before it broke in the press earlier than they wanted.
They had their reasons for doing what they did, and Stanky had to have signed off on it, the head of AT&T, John Stanky, but they handled it so badly. And the repercussions have been so dire. I mean, to have CAA and all the agencies and all the guilds and everybody on your back like this.
Lots of lawsuits.
And lawsuits, exactly. So Disney followed with a much milder version of this, a much more sensitive version of this. And they're clearly heading toward a version of the same thing at the moment, but they have a theatrical, they have a theatrical component with Marvel and Pixar and everything else that will not go away. And neither will, by the way, I still maintain that at the end of the year, next year, they shouldn't have done the whole year. That was dumb. But at the end of the year, when they, you know, they're going to have to recalibrate and decide what their theatrical business is.
We'll have to keep coming back to this thing. Each time another one of these movies comes along, we'll have to take another, because there are different scales, different kinds of audiences and so forth. So it's not a one-size-fits-all thing. And that's part of the problem, is making the announcement about all of them like that. Well, another big impact was on the talent itself. And that's the next item on our countdown, which is a COVID impact on talent, which I think has been fascinating to see, because nobody had to, you know, do those grueling long hours at hotel junkets this year. You know, the promotional machine has been a completely different beast, because we're all in little boxes, right? And I certainly enjoyed doing all these Instagram live conversations. I found that talent needed to be visible however possible, and it forced them to sort of adapt a kind of DIY ethos. I've enjoyed talking, as you know, about this breakout performance from Maria Bakalova. But one of the things that's interesting about that story was that that's like the ultimate kind of overnight star, right? Nobody knew who this Bulgarian actress was until Borat came along. But then usually what you would have is red carpets and parties and stuff, and you'd have rubbing shoulders with all this talent. And you'd sort of get born into the Hollywood scene through that overnight stardom. But right now, you can't do that. So the whole concept of the breakout has changed this year. You have to be visible online.
On a negative side, especially watching young emerging filmmakers, it's harder for them.
Yes. You know, you can't work the room.
Everything we've talked about, the festivals, the all of the usual apparatus for building a star is not there. But Bakalova is doing okay.
She's doing okay, but the studios, I think, will probably want to keep the virtual junkets because it's so much easier and cheaper than flying people out to do all these crazy things if you can actually, in an effective kind of way, frame them on Zoom.
I think there'll be some of one thing and some of another. I'm curious to see how that develops. But stars have learned. They have learned that they can stay in their living room and they don't have to go and they don't have to travel and they don't have to fly. And people who were always being separated from their families, I think across the industry, have learned that they can be home and they can be with their families and work at the same time. And I think that could be a positive over time.
Well, I feel like I kind of encroached on your territory because the next item on our list is yours, and that's the rise of Zoom.
I think we just covered it.
There's more in there. I do think it's interesting. You know, I taught a class on Zoom. My class in the spring went virtual in the middle of the semester. My class in the fall was entirely virtual. And people don't realize how effective this platform is. I mean, we're lucky that it existed. There are others that people use, Google Hangs or whatever, but it's really hard to just create a platform where you send somebody a link and they don't have to log in as soon as they're on there. That's why it has security issues, obviously, but it's a very effective platform in that respect. And they seem to have risen to their moment in that sense.
And we've all gotten used to it. Yeah, you know, it's just I've had, you know, my book group and meetings and my
parties,
class.
Happy hours. We had our holiday party on. Yeah,
absolutely. That was strange.
So, very strange, but fun. We had a good time. It's doable. That's the point. Until people listen to me and buy those VR headset so we can all actually hang out in a virtual world. It's a half step in that direction. So, but people should get those headsets. Now, on a more meaningful note, the second item on our countdown is the impact of the election on Hollywood. A lot of us, I think, started to realize that Hollywood was not going to be our answer to the election after coming out of the PTSD of 2016 and our liberal bubbles and how much we sort of, you know, you start to assume that because you're seeing your view confirmed certain places, it must be the view that is going to determine the outcome of something like an election. So we look at our storytellers and we say, yeah, stick it to the, you know, close-minded GOP people and assume that's what's going to happen. And then it doesn't, because America is a big and complicated place and getting out the vote requires a lot of efforts on all sides. But from the efforts that Spike Lee and David Byrne made with American Utopia, all the way to what Borat did, telling people to get out the vote and punking Giuliani, it did feel like there was this mobilization effort that was based around voting that did something very smart, which was not to say we're not just going to like go do events for Joe Biden. We're going to engage people in the actual physical process of voting because that's what makes a difference, not just thinking about stuff. And I think they did rise to the occasion.
I think Hollywood really did participate big time in across the board.
And gave money.
I was very aware of it on Twitter. I was very aware of, you know, just little things like Mandy Patinkin and his wife, you know, filling out their postcards and just modeling. Yeah. You were very good.
We all did it.
I modeled
we all did the
you,
postcards.
You know.
And let me say one thing on this, which is very important, I think, because no matter what happens in the news cycle, by the time people hear this, there is still a runoff election happening in Georgia on January 5th that will determine control of the Senate. And that's so important. It is an extension of the value of the presidential election. I don't think the world will end if we don't get both of those seats on the Democratic side.
We've got to get one, at least.
It will be easy. And you look at who they're running against, somebody like Raphael Warnock.
That's running.
It's so much more powerful, Warnock, than Kelly Loeffler, or even David Perdue, who's a crook, and John Ossoff, who's a young, retired documentary filmmaker who has decided that it's probably better for his career to be in politics. So I'm supportive of both of them, and I'm writing postcards to them.
I send money.
Sending them money. It really still matters. And that's not going to go away. My hope is that what Hollywood and everybody else gets out of this is that elections come up a lot. And this isn't just a one-time deal because we had the worst president in the history of this country. It's something that we'll always have to be cognizant of.
Finally, the Democrats and everyone roused themselves to recognize the threat that was finally so apparent. And thank God they did. And thank God sanity is about to return. I mean, other movies, by the way, that participated in that effort included The Trial of the Chicago Seven, which Aaron Sorkin definitely wanted to have out in time, and the great Stacey Abrams doc, which I think really did have an impact.
Yeah, that actually was the reason why I started picking up the phone and calling voters.
Yeah, and, I think that had a big impact. It scared people to death.
Yeah, well, it was a well-made movie. I mean,
it was Liz Garbus.
And Liz Garbus and Lisa Cortez made a movie that is talking heads in a way that actually has substance to it. It explains voter suppression in a way that we really needed to hear at that moment, and we're going to continue to need to hear because, again, it's a Stacey Abrams movie, and the Georgia runoff is coming up. So bring us home. Right.
So, but needless to say, the story of the year, which it couldn't be more dramatic, is the rise of the streamers. You know, at the same time that government entities are trying to curb what's going on Facebook and Google and all that, Amazon, Apple, Disney Plus, HBO Max, and Peacock over at Universal. These are all
Quibi. Don't forget about Quibi.
And R-I-T. Quibi died a dismal death. Thank you very much. So Netflix, still steady as they go, still ahead of everybody else, still smarter than everybody else, still gets it, still has this extraordinary relationship with the consumer. But the others are catching up, and they're not stupid. Even if Stanky and Kalar could be described as stupid, there are a lot of smart people trying to make these things work. Roku finally came on board with HBO Max, which is a big deal. I didn't realize that Roku was like 40% of that market, that it was so dominant.
That's because you're not a user
company.
They're
the bridge. You can't get on all these systems without them. Unless you're doing Apple Plus. But Apple Plus is less, and Apple TV Plus is another factor. So they're all coming along, and obviously Disney Plus is the most successful challenger to the Netflix throne.
But I also feel like they're weirdly complementary at this point in the market. If you look at them, I mean, I get whiplash being like watching the Disney investors thing and being like, oh, wow, they have so much going on. That's a real threat to Netflix. And then I go on Netflix and I'm like, wow, Netflix has market penetration all over the world. There's no way Disney can compete with that. And then I look back at Disney, I'm like, well, maybe they're going to compete. I mean, it's just a constant back and forth. And it's great.
Netflix,
I think,
is
that's
ahead.
Positive.
But remember, I mean, the unfortunate thing is that Amazon is so wealthy, right? Bezos is the most wealthy person who ever lived, and beyond anything, he's not even a billionaire. He's a trillionaire. You know?
Thankfully, he seems like he has some morality in check.
He has some, and the Washington Post is part of it. But he also has this extraordinary, set of mansions and everything else.
He's going to go to space too. I mean, he's all over the place.
The space race: Tom Cruise versus the billionaire.
That's true. He's in Elon Musk camp.
Right.
Yeah,
exactly. Anyway, so you do have a certain kind of wealth that's attached to, and even Disney, even if it's beleaguered right now, will recover. And wealth disparity too. You know, with Disney paying its executives full freight and then laying off its employees who can't make their rent, but That's another story. Anyway, the streamers are here to stay, and it will be fascinating to see how Hollywood morphs into the future.
Irrespective of all of that, Anne, I'm really looking forward to seeing you in person and watching movies on a big screen, going to film festivals, hanging out at parties, and talking about the streaming wars. It's this weird thing that's happening in tandem with our need to be places in person. So fingers crossed for 2021 and Happy New Year to you. I'll see you. Well, we'll be rushing right
you
into January.
I will be rushing around our virtual version of Sundance.
Exactly. I'll see you in the virtual snow. Happy New Year.
Bye-bye. Love you, Eric.